From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park Podcast.
This is MC Fontaine, welcoming you to another Bletchley Park Podcast Extra. We again return to the Turing Education Day. This week's talk is by Baroness Susan Greenfield. Linking in with both Turing's work in computing and artificial intelligence, it's titled How Brain Power Goes Beyond Computer Power.
You might wonder why I'm actually here, because I stand before you unashamedly as a neuroscientist. I know very little about computers, but what I do know is that there are questions that neuroscience is posing that may be of relevance to the people in this room, that may be of interest both in measuring up against the checks and balances of what computer science has succeeded or not succeeded in answering, but more excitingly, in the future, what might be the issues where we can interface between computational science and neuroscience. The area that I think is one of the most exciting and the one I want to cut to straight away is the one that really no science, irrespective of your discipline, has come up with, in my mind, a convincing approach to resolving, and that is the issue of consciousness. Now, we could try and wrestle around on defining consciousness. That's very difficult because normally when we define something, we use an operational definition, such as flight is when you defy gravity, or we use reference to a higher set, such as a table is a piece of furniture, love is an emotion, consciousness is a what? There's no higher set. So normally we stumble around trying to define consciousness, but can I be very unscientific and say we all know what consciousness is, don't we? It's what you're going to lose tonight, and I know this will offend philosophers hugely. If you're anaesthetized, it's what you lose. And let's informally just say it's the first person, personal world as it seems to you. It's the world that no one else can hack into firsthand. So however close you are to the person sitting next to you, no one can hack into your head and see the world through your eyes. The other differentiation we need to clarify is what type of consciousness we're talking about, because sometimes these do get conflated. First is self-consciousness, or what some people refer to as higher states. We could also talk about shifts in consciousness. We could talk about the subconscious, that is to say, you're driving along thinking some deep and dark thoughts about what's been happening in work. A child steps out in front of you and you can process the brake, hopefully, while you are conscious but of which you are not aware. So these are different types of consciousness that people often confuse when they're arguing about consciousness, and I want to just really concentrate on this, which to my mind is the most exciting. The crucial excitement is, what is the difference between when you're asleep and when you are awake? What's happening in the brain that allows you to enjoy this rich inner experience that no one else is sharing? David Chalmers, an Australian philosopher, earned his fame by this simple phrase, the hard problem. Whereas the other issues, perhaps that of attention or the evolutionary value of consciousness, intriguing though they are not as hard conceptually as this one. And I want to pose a question to you now because I want to return to it. If I said to you, and I'm afraid I won't be able to deliver this, if I said to you, okay, today I'm going to unveil how the brain generates consciousness, what would you expect me to show you? Would you think I'm going to show you a performing rat or a formula, computer program, a brain scan? Are you suddenly going to feel like me? And until we can really approach, however resource-rich it may be, it doesn't matter, what kind of answer will satisfy that problem, then I think it is going to be the hard problem. So what are the possible approaches? Well, modelling in synthetic systems is something that seems to be a very straightforward idea. People talk about, well, you have a computer to model consciousness. I really do have problems with the notion of a model, because a model implies you know the salient features so that you can exclude the extraneous features. So if you're to model flight, you can have a plane, and that doesn't have beaks and feathers, yet it is capturing the essential feature of defying gravity. Now, with consciousness, by definition, if you don't know what the salient feature is, how are you going to build it? And how are you going to extract the non-salient, the extraneous features in a biological system? If you knew that already, you wouldn't have to build the model. So I don't quite see how people saying they can model consciousness is going to solve the problem of consciousness, because that is the solution if you can do it. The next idea is to build an ever more complex robot. People like this idea. And I've actually just written a novel where this happens, where you have talking heads that kind of smile at you and you come back and you say, I've had a really hard day today. And they say, oh, you poor thing. Or, you know, grinning at you, they might say, you've just lost all your files. Ha, 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 or something. If they were really devious, yeah. But you can imagine coming back to this person at the end of a hard day. But the idea is that they can recognize face and respond and give prosody, that's the right kind of voices, so that you can have what might seem to be like a conversation with a sentient creature. And of course they're not, irrespective of the behaviours they're emitting. That brings us then to the Turing test. Just to remind you, the notion was that anyone given impartial access to either a computer or a person and allowed to ask whatever question you wished, then a computer would pass the Turing test if you couldn't tell the difference in the answers. To the best of my knowledge, no computer has passed the Turing test. But I gather it's one or two human beings that have failed it, which is people think, oh, perhaps we, there we are, I failed the Turing test. I think we could all nominate people that are candidates for failing the Turing test. Nonetheless, I would query that, although it could show the complexity of a computer compared to a human brain, that doesn't prove that either are conscious, of course, because you can have responses from anything, and however sophisticated the response is, doesn't mean to say that there is an inner state backing them up. There's a philosopher called John Searle who introduced a very famous thought game called the Chinese Room, which illustrates that very point. So this notion, then, of either building a more complex robot or one that satisfies the Turing test, I don't think does it in terms of approaches for really understanding how the water is turned into the wine, how the bump and grind of the physicochemical world is translated from an objective phenomena into a subjective inner state. So what about this one? A property of mere, in inverted commas, because it's far from mere, complexity. You may be familiar with someone called Ray Kurzweil in the States and his notion of the singularity, this idea that progress is going to screech up exponentially in computational power and soon the computers will only have us around their homes as household pets kind of thing. This is the notion that you can have an ever more complex system that will actually overtake a biological brain, and he's produced graphs which don't give us much hope here. We've got almost an insect brain being outstripped by the computational power with the exponential growth of computing. By about 2060, I think, we're going to be outcompeted computationally, according to him, by artificial devices. Is this not depressing? Does this really mean that all we are computational devices, such that we can be quantitatively outstripped by machines? So let's think about that, whether consciousness itself would render itself to a computational process or whether truly, as I'm going to argue, it is a non-computational process. That doesn't mean to say, of course, all the boffins in this room could not tackle the problem. It's just that I think people have approached this from a pure algorithmic point of view. Niels Bohr, who I'm sure everyone's familiar with, I love this quote, "You're not thinking, you're just being logical." Wonderful. Yeah. He said to a student once. And Roger Penrose, a mathematician, he has problems with this notion that it's tractable to pure algorithmic development because he says, what about intuition and common sense, let alone consciousness itself? That's not to say it's impossible, but we can't take it as an article of faith that all these things are going to happen just because we say they could or we can have some science fiction scenario of them. As a neurobiologist, the problem I have is that the brain is not a brain in a vat, as philosophers would have it. It is actually part of your body in the whole part of your body, and that the central nervous system and the immune system and the endocrine system all have to work in concert, otherwise you'd have biological anarchy. So this means that you can't isolate one of those systems and expect it to function fully fledged out of the context of interfacing with the other great control systems of the body. And what I'm going to argue towards the end is that actually it does require feedback and interfacing in order to function properly. The importance of the body was highlighted, for example, by someone called Antonio Damasio, an American neuroscientist, who argues the importance of so-called somatic markers, soma, the Greek body, whereby you have markers floating around in the periphery which feed back to the brain and vice versa. And he argues quite persuasively on how feedback from these markers within the body can actually influence how you're feeling. And he has some experiments where he shows those kinds of things. So you can't think of the brain in a vat. And kind of the studies I'm going to show you that we do of brain slices in organ baths, I am not, let me say now, going to pretend they're conscious. They're not. They're telling us about brain mechanisms, but you do need the whole brain, in my view, a whole body. And that is, I think, an issue for the computational approach in its simplest form, is that you do need to nest it into feedback and integration with the other systems that are going on. This brings us to the qualitative dimension of the very diverse chemicals that exist not just in the brain, but the body. And we heard a little bit earlier about how one might be able to translate one into the other. You might be able to have quantity turn into quality. That is to say, we know that in cells, for example, the frequency with which the little electrical blips that are the signal of them being active, according to the frequency with which they discharge, you can have different chemicals released. So we know that you can go from quantity to chemistry in some cases, or perhaps the other way around. But nonetheless, the quality in biology is very important. And I do apologize, but I'm not apologizing, because you are a very sophisticated technical audience, is this chemical acetylcholine called ACH, which is a chemical messenger, one of many in the brain, has different functions according to the context in which it is working. The whole point being that molecules don't have functions locked inside them as intrinsic properties. They're much more like people. They behave according to the context and the interaction in which they are placed. People talk about inhibitory transmitters, or like you might talk about an angry person or a hat. It's not like that. It depends very much on the interrelationship. And I think this touches a little bit perhaps on what Maggie was talking about, with higher order complexity coming out of something that's intrinsically quite straightforward and simple. If then we think about the quality and the need for a qualitative dimension, if we were going to go computational, then I don't think it's impossible, but it is a consideration that I've often seen ignored. What about criteria for consciousness? Because if I've said you can't define it, then we have a bit of a problem here, because how are we going to know it when we see it, and what we're going to do? Instead of criteria, let's draw up a shopping list of what we would want the brain and indeed the body to deliver in order for us to be able to come out with some kind of satisfactory description. I won't say explanation, because I've just said how we turn the water into wine is still awaiting a very general scenario of what we might expect. What we as neuroscientists can do is look for so-called correlations, which are kind of descriptions. That's to say, we can describe physical things happening in the brain that match up with subjective states. That is possible. Let's take a very simple example. If you take Prozac and your depression is alleviated, then you can correlate a biochemical action, in this case increasing the availability of a chemical messenger serotonin, with an alleviation of mood. How that happens, of course, we don't know, but we can do a correlation. So what we're after here are correlations within the brain, looking at physical brain states and how they might match up to subjective conscious states. Now, the first thing, pretty obvious, is you can see there's different brain regions. The cauliflower thing on the back, the so-called cerebellum, the outer layer that's all wrinkled in humans, the stalky bit, the brainstem. Where is the center for consciousness? Perhaps there's a center for consciousness. Now, that is, again, a fallacy for people that really would like to try and reduce the problem to a component part. Do you remember the Beezer comic, anyone? The numbskulls lived inside a little man's head, and they got him up to no end of mischief. You have the consciousness department on the top left, and they have the crisp-eating department. I think this is a metaphor for how people think how the brain works, especially when they look at brain scans often, because they think you have the center for this and the center for that. But even if you did, what would that tell you? How would that explain anything or enlighten you in any way? It wouldn't. It's just a word, a center for this. What goes on inside the numbskull's head? Are there mini numbskulls? And inside the mini numbskulls, are there micro numbskulls? Inside the micro numbskulls, you get nano numbskulls. Yeah, you can miniaturize the problem, but that is what Ramachandran once called an anesthetic explanation, i.e. it's not an explanation, even though it sounds like one. So just to try and reduce the brain to different mini brains, to different brain areas, isn't very, very helpful. And moreover, not only is it logically rather implausible, but if you actually look at anesthetic administered with people having non-invasive brain imaging, you can see that as the anesthetic is deepening, the activity in the brain is reducing. It's not as if one single brain area is being extinguished. And if there was a center for consciousness when you came along with your anesthetic, then you'd see it. So the problem then is there is no thing as a center for consciousness. Second, what about non-human versus human consciousness? How are we going to get around that? Well, I'm sure many of you have dogs or cats. Now, there's a chanting picture here. Why is it enchanting? It's because the dog is doing something outside of the canine repertoire. So this is a human behavior. That's why we find it enchanting. Why? Because the human behavior doesn't match up with what we think dogs think like. So clearly, we don't think dogs think like us. And yet, I'm sure many of you have cats or dogs. If I said, I bet you your dog isn't conscious, I'd get lynched. So I think we've moved on from Descartes, where only humans were conscious. But where is this difference then? And if we are to have an adequate explanation of consciousness, if we're going to, whether we're computationalists or whether we're biologists, we're going to approach the problem, we have to square that circle. We have to face up to the issue of how we're going to factor in animal versus human consciousness. And again, if you look at the anatomy, where's the difference? Of course there's a difference in size, but the theme is the same. I can't see a lump stuck on the human brain called consciousness area. So where would you draw the Rubicon for where one species in the animal kingdom is conscious and then a related species is not? You clearly can't, because the theme in evolution is the same, and it's a continuum. To press home that point, I had a marine biologist working with me in the lab at one stage, and he drew my attention to the common octopus. Remember Paul, the octopus who had prescient powers over the World Cup? He was a common octopus. And obviously he was conscious, otherwise he wouldn't have known the World Cup scores. Whereas the Elhedon cirrhosa, a related species, does not have the same home office protection that the Paul species would have had. They're very similar, they're both octopuses. So this shows how arbitrary it is to draw a line attributing consciousness to one species and yet not to another. So my own view is that this is a similar problem to the highly controversial one of if a fetus is conscious. In the old days, it was assumed that a fetus wasn't conscious. But if a fetus is not conscious, when does it become conscious? Is it as it's squishing down the birth canal? Well, that's a bit tough if you're born by cesarean section, you're never going to be conscious. Or is it exactly at the full term? So perhaps you've had, some of you in this room, a premature baby, or yourself been a premature baby. Can you imagine how absurd it would be to be sitting at home with your partner saying, oh, look, baby's not conscious yet, they're going to be conscious in a few days' time, we'll go up to the hospital then and see it. No. Clearly, neither the manner of birth or the timing of birth is a Rubicon again that you cross. Suddenly the lights don't all go on. How can we get around that? Well, there is an interesting idea. And do you remember when I showed you the anaesthetic picture, you saw that the anaesthetic was slowly reducing consciousness? Well, we know that in anaesthesia, when that happens, this is something called BIS monitoring, you can actually quantify the level of anaesthesia. This is really helpful because it does evolve over anaesthetizing people and killing them. And the very occasional but very, very distressing situation that we sometimes hear about, where someone in surgery is fully conscious but can't report the fact and is therefore obviously in terrible pain. The way around this is through this system where the EEGs are monitored, you can actually quantify the level of consciousness. Now, this struck me when I was reflecting on it as something that could give us a big clue. Perhaps I've been leading up the garden path here and making a rather silly assumption. We talk about consciousness and unconsciousness. Why do we have to assume that? If you can have levels or grades of unconsciousness, if it's continuously variable, why can't consciousness also be continuously variable? Why can't we have levels of consciousness? So a fetus would be conscious, but not as conscious as a child, and a child would be as conscious, not as conscious as an adult, and a rat would be conscious, but not as conscious as a primate, and a primate would be conscious, a monkey say, but not as conscious as a human. So you could have levels or degrees of consciousness. What if consciousness was like a dimmer switch? So instead of the light going on or off, you could have degrees of it. Now, this would be very helpful because not only would it get around that riddle of fetal consciousness and differential animal consciousness, but it would also suggest that you as an adult human being could be more conscious at some times than at other times. And therefore, is that it turns again a qualitative phenomenon into a quantitative one. And of course, as scientists, whether we're biologists or physical scientists, we deal in quantity, not quality. So if we can actually now look for something that varies in degree in the brain, then it could be modelled. It could be quantified. We could start to measure it, which is, of course, what we are all in the business of doing. So if we could find a process where consciousness is continuously variable, then that could be matched up, from my stance, my particular interest, with different levels of consciousness or subjective states of consciousness, and we could start to understand different types of consciousness that the human condition offers us. So let's have a think about that. What we'd need to do is we'd have to find some mid-level brain process. The action potentials, those electrical blips, are all or none, and therefore they're not very helpful. Just looking at one of them, although you get to higher time resolution, you can't see how it works in the context of the rest of the brain. And if we're going to coin football analogies, being topical, it's a bit like watching one footballer playing and sometimes standing still, sometimes running. It doesn't tell you the progress of the game. So although it can be useful, it's a rather isolated, reductionist way of looking at the brain. By contrast, the whole brain imaging, such as magnetic resonance imaging, Again, it's very powerful diagnostically, but it has a very low time resolution, a time resolution of seconds. And bear in mind, the action potential is milliseconds. So I often think that although it gives you steady state readouts or is very useful diagnostically, it's not very good for looking at transient states because it's a little like those Victorian photographs where the time resolution was so slow. With great fidelity, of course, you could see buildings, but you couldn't see animals or people moving around among the buildings. So it wasn't giving you the wrong picture, but it was also not giving you the whole picture. And I think that with brain imaging, that's the case. It's not giving us the whole picture. We need something that is on the same timescale commensurate with action potentials, with real cells, and it has to be a mid-level process that is not static anatomical brain regions lighting up, and it's not single brain cells. And such a process, which we're now working with, and it's relatively new to neuroscience, last 10 or 20 years, is those of neuronal assemblies, which we define as variable, highly transient macroscale groups of brain cells. These have a spatial resolution on the subsecond scale, and they usually exceed 10 million in number of cells. So these are large-scale coalitions of brain cells that are transiently corralled up in less than a second, and then they're gone. And I'd like to suggest to you that the extent of such a coalition could correlate, could match up with the extent of or depth of consciousness. Just think of a stone in a puddle. The analogy I'd like to show is that you can have a trigger, such as a stone, but that will nonetheless trigger a highly evanescent excursion in the brain, a coalition of brain cells that lasts for a very short period of time, like ripples last for a very short time. And just like you can have those ripples curtailed either by more ripples formed, or the excursion will be determined by the size of the stone or the force with which it's thrown, all that can contribute to your consciousness at any one time. So we are using optical dyes. These are dyes that embed in the membrane of the cells, which is why you can't use them in humans, unfortunately. And they will change their wavelength. You'll be able to detect them according to the voltage across the cell membrane, which is, of course, what happens when you have an action potential. That's what it is. It's a change in the potential difference across the cell membrane. And you can see that even within 18 milliseconds after a 0.1 microsecond stimulus, that we are seeing a clear effect with clear spatial variation within it that could then be explored and studied. So we know these neuronal assemblies are formed and disbanded in less than a second. We are doing these in brain slices. You can also do them in vivo on the cortex of living animals, but the restraint is that you can't do them in humans. So how do these assemblies actually form? If we were to model this again, what do we need to know? Well, in the brain, there's kind of fountains. Some chemical messengers don't just do little circuit operations, but they act like fountains. And all these agents play a large part in many, many functions, but above all, arousal and sleep-wake cycles, relevant, therefore, if we are thinking about consciousness. They are very diffuse. They come from a very primitive part of the brain and act like fountains to modulate it. So say you see your mother, and let's hope your mother has many associations for you, and so therefore there'll be lots of hardwired neuronal connections forged by the interrelationship between you and your mother. We know that brains are plastic, that is to say they adapt to their environment, and they do so by forming local circuit connections that will give the world a meaning that is personalized to you and to no one else. So let's say you see your mother, this epicenter, this hardwired hub of cells, that's like the stone. It's too local and it's too long-lasting to give you consciousness, but it's there, nascent in your brain. If now you are awake and or even excited, these modulating chemicals, of which we've seen, will kind of put the cells on red alert. They will predispose them to being more sensitive now to signals. So the conjunction of the stone having lots of associations, being big therefore, or perhaps something sensory. Think of an alarm clock, say, a very simple thing, which is just pure sensing. The combination of a loud physical sensory stimulus coupled by something that might have personalized cognitive significance, coupled with your arousal levels, all those things will determine how big at any one time a neuronal assembly would be. How can we characterize this? Well, this is a brief film. This is an assembly in action. And I'd like you to look here at the time scale. This is the 0.0 second readout. And we're stimulating here remotely. And you can see, I hope, the assembly forming. So you see how fast it is. And this is slowed down. That's 260 milliseconds. Then it goes. So that's what we mean by assemblies. And this is a movie showing very quickly baseline agent washout, the brief stimulus at 6 milliseconds, there is an emphasis on the epicentre, the red area, but as things speed on, that when we get to about 70 milliseconds, the baseline has gone completely, but the agent is still causing an effect. So this is, for us, a powerful way of understanding these assemblies. If you were modelling consciousness, the other problem you've got to come around is, how are you going to differentiate the subjective experience of hearing and vision from the physiological reality that after it's been transduced from the cochlea or the retina, it's the same, they're volleys of action potentials. So where does that hugely important qualitative difference come in after you've had the same transformation? Because in brain terms, everything is processed in a similar way. There is no clear qualitative difference between the two. And if we can understand these assemblies, then we can extrapolate from brain slices to working in whole animals. When we anaesthetize the animal more deeply, of course, it has to be anaesthetized throughout, you can see with deep anaesthesia, the assembly is smaller, which is what you would have expected. It's shrinking the assembly. Moreover, if we give the animal a so-called enriched environment compared to the rather squalid, less enriched environment, when we then look at them in experiments, the assemblies are bigger than in the controls, showing that we're having long-term effects. And I think this might be important for understanding the evolutionary value of consciousness, in that if you're having an interactive, stimulating environment, actually changing the depth of your consciousness, that could actually point to one of the questions. Can neural assemblies actually be linked to consciousness? Up until now, we've been bedeviled by the fact that we were restricted to working animals and they can't tell you how they're feeling and the states that they're having. Brian Pollard at Manchester last year, however, has come up with this technique called functional electrical impedance tomography. And unlike normal brain imaging, non-invasive brain imaging, it has a real-time time resolution. I'm in touch with Professor Pollard, and I hope in the future we could actually devise some experiments where we could test out this hypothesis. But I want to stress it's a correlation. What we are not doing, because we don't know where to even start, is to say what kind of question would satisfy this problem. Where does it leave us? I see the mind, brain, and consciousness as all very different things. The mind are the hardwired hub of associations or connections, whereby one can talk about beliefs, or one can talk about whether it's value of democracy or power of prayer or the placebo effect. All these beliefs can be expressed in their different ways in terms of the associations and the robustness of those associations to other things coming in. Obviously, with the brain, one talks about neuronal networks, and you can talk about the firm-wired local circuits as opposed to the transient, highly global ones, the assemblies. And then we talk about consciousness, the subjective experience. Now, that, I think, can go along a sliding scale, whereby for very small children or animals, when you are in the moment, it's primarily driven by the input coming in from the outside world, from the senses. But slowly, as we become adult humans, we develop a dialogue with the outside world where very much of what we evaluate around us is determined by the existing associations or connections, and indeed updated by ongoing experience. And then eventually, not I've ever done this, but if one can get to states of meditation and so on, you can shut out the outside world altogether and have an inner state. So one can think of the adult human brain as having degrees of consciousness, of variability, determined by the interference or otherwise from the outside world. How do these all link? Well, mind, personalized belief systems, can be expressed, I think, in terms of the plasticity of the brain, and similarly the assemblies, as shown by the second or third thick black arrow, can be expressed in terms of the assemblies. And then that spans philosophy, psychology, neuroscience, and theology. Where does computation come in? I think it comes into all of that. But I would like to suggest to you that rather than coming up with simplistic models, it's much better to start with the biology and come up with a mathematical description, as we're trying to do with our assemblies now, than to start with a model and try and force biology to comply with that in a somewhat simplistic way. Could be that this is where we have come up against the limitations of biology, and where those of you who have a strong theoretical bias might be able to come up, please do come up, with the miracle. Thank you very much.
Why not follow our channel on Audioboo, where you can also subscribe to the RSS feed, or subscribe to us on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter, where we're at BPartPodcast, or join the Bletchley Park Podcast Facebook group. Once again, we must thank the Alan Turing Year and all the speakers involved for these recordings, and of course, Audioboo, who make this podcast possible.